Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day and welcome to the YPO-WPO Global Diplomacy and Public Policy Network call, the Game of Camps Episode 2 Iran Perspective Practitioner View conference call on the 11th of August 2015. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Cyrus Rezaghi. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and hello, everybody, and thank you for participating in today's call. And a big thanks to the Global Diplomacy and Public Policy Network, chaired by Yariv Cohen, for the initiative to organize the call. I'm Cyrus Rezaghi from the Greater MENA and Northeastern U.S. chapters, moderating this call from Tehran. So we have a great resource today, Dr. Hans Jacob Schindler, who is an expert on the subject matters discussed on this call, and has kindly agreed to provide his analysis and educate us today. This is the second of a series of five calls on critical regional issues. It is a one-hour call, starting with Dr. Schindler's presentation for about 25 to 30 minutes. On the Vienna Agreement between Iran and the Group of 5+1, the key parts of the agreement and the challenges and opportunities that it may represent down the road. And the call will be open for roughly a 30-minute Q&A session. The call is being recorded, and an archived link will be posted on the Global Diplomacy and Public Policy and Peace Action Network pages on Exchange. I'd like to remind us all that the views expressed in this call are those of our resource and are not the views of YPO as a non-political organization. As the stage is open for all to discuss and share, we will provide a view from one side of the region on each call, allowing members to provide an alternative perspective on successive calls. The next episode in Game of Camps will bring the U.S. viewpoint. If you missed the previous call, Israel's view on the shifting region, please revisit it via the network's homepage. If you'd like to suggest additional chapters with other viewpoints, please propose succeeding calls with real practitioners that you might know via email to the network. Now, after 2 years of intense and complex negotiations and with a 12-year standoff between Iran and the international community over Iran's nuclear program, a comprehensive deal was finally reached in Vienna last month. We heard the Israeli point of view on the last call, or at least the side of it that doesn't agree with the deal, and now we have the chance to hear the balancing view to that. So without further delay, allow me to introduce our resource today. Dr. Hans Jacob Schindler has wide international experience in diplomacy, intelligence, and security. He's currently leading the UN Security Council sanctions monitoring team and has been an active advisor to the Group of 5+1 negotiations team on behalf of Germany. His experience spans throughout the Middle East, handling delicate dialogues and crises. For 6 years, he served as a special advisor to the German ambassador here in Tehran until 2011, and led the crisis management team of the embassy during the 2006 and 2009-10 disturbances in Iran. Throughout his career, he has worked in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia, and Israel, where he spent about a year of working on his PhD. His duties included the development of homeland security measures as well as risk mitigation, specifically towards insider threats. He has also advised European and global corporations on international sanctions. Hans holds master's and PhD degrees in international terrorism from St. Andrews University. So with that impressive background, let me now turn you over to Dr. Schindler. Hans?
Hi, good morning, good day, and good evening to wherever time zones you are calling in. I have to start my small presentation with a very short caveat. Obviously, you heard that I'm advising the United Nations Security Council, so my views expressed in this call are not necessarily the views of the United Nations Security Council. I'm not speaking on behalf of the UN. I'm speaking on behalf of myself. And I'm giving you my assessment, my analysis, born out of my personal experiences working on the issue. So please don't misunderstand this as any way the Security Council talking to you about sanctions. I have been asked to address a few points in the presentation that might actually be of interest to the listeners, so I will simply go along the structure that was pre-agreed and start with looking very shortly at Iran's past nuclear history. Just to give you a background why this issue became such an important and such a complicated issue. As you may know from reading about the subject, the civilian nuclear program in Iran did not start with the Islamic Revolution. It did, in fact, start under the Pahlavi regime with cooperation of the United States. Just as one example, the Tehran nuclear research reactor was built by the United States in Tehran. However, with the revolution, this complete program was stopped, and during the Iran-Iraq war, no progress was achieved. Actually, regress was achieved when Iraq bombarded the Bushehr reactor. Therefore, until about the 90s, under the Rafsanjani presidency, nothing really continued on that path. But then the regime very clearly made a decision to develop its nuclear program in several ways. On the one hand, it wanted to finish the nuclear reactor in Bushehr. It was about 80% finished, built by a German company called Atomunion, which later on was bought by Siemens. The cooperation with Russia on Bushehr only came about since Siemens refrained from finishing the reactor once the Islamic Republic asked it to do. And the second strategic decision that the regime was doing was to develop a domestic enrichment capacity. This arose out of an experience that Iran, under the Pahlavis, had invested heavily in Eurodif. They bought about a 10% share, which is a consortium of enrichment related activities inside Europe. So they were actually entitled to receive nuclear reactor fuel and enriched uranium from Eurodif, but the Eurodif refrained under political pressure from giving that to the Islamic Republic. So the decision was made to build up a domestic enrichment capacity. And the third area is a little bit murky, but clearly, if not the regime, then someone in the regime discussed and put some research paths in place on how to weaponize if necessary. So it wasn't a decision to build a nuclear weapon. It wasn't a decision to, in a very stringent, like the Pakistanis or the Indians, aim the entire program towards weaponization, but there was certainly some parts of the regime that thought about at least keeping the option open later on to weaponize. Rouhani, when he was still the General Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, talked to us in Germany about this and explained that even inside the regime, no one really had a good overview who was doing what research in this kind of beginning chaotic time in the 1990s where everything was pushed forward at the same time. So there was, of course, very strictly, legally speaking, not 100% clear violation of Iran's commitment under non-proliferation treaty, but it was equally clear that Iran acted in a very suspicious way. Parts of the regime were trying to cover something up, and that led everyone to the conclusion that there was at least some kind of tactics involved that may aim for what's weaponization. In 2002, this all came down when the full extent of the then at the, this time civilian nuclear program became clear, especially with the Esfahan and the Natanz facilities. That very quickly led to the formation of the E3 at that time, led by Germany, included the UK and France, to discuss and negotiate a first agreement with Iran, trying to rectify what was on the ground with Iran's commitments in the NPT and trying to solve this crisis diplomatically. So it led to the Sadabat and the Paris Agreements and the signature of Iran of the additional protocol, but not the ratification of the NPT additional protocol by Iran. In 2005, this was the end of the Sadabat and Paris Agreement, and the idea originally was to then let it follow on with a new agreement, a permanent agreement, something similar to what we have today. The E3, to be totally honest, my perspective was they missed simply to close the deal. This was a question, do we do it before or after the presidential elections? There were good arguments to do it beforehand. You had a Khatami government, you knew the negotiators, you knew who you're dealing with, or wait until after the presidential elections with a new government at that time. The Europeans and many others assumed it would be Rafsanjani. You could get a very strong president again. You could get a better deal maybe afterwards. So the decision was made to wait until just before the presidential election so that the next administration would be closing the deal with the Europeans. Unfortunately, the predictions were all wrong. Ahmadinejad came in as a new president, a completely unknown figure, or widely unknown figure in Europe. And as you know, from that time onwards, things didn't go very well. He basically ended the Sadabat Paris Agreement. He refrained from negotiating a next stage agreement. And then from 2006 onwards, the situation simply politically escalated and led to the dossier being brought from the IAEA to the United Nations Security Council. And since that time, a lot of questions then started with the enrichment capacity, the Fordow plant that the Iranians built, the going back from the notification time, code 3.1 old version to 3.1 new version, i.e. the Iranians would only later notify the IAEA, the Parchin sign, the possible military dimension. So the problems mounted with the program simply because there was no real negotiations going on between Iran and the P5+1 at that time. Not that there wasn't enough efforts being made, but the Iranian side was simply quite hardline, developed the program, met with the international negotiators, but never really came prepared with A, any proposals, or B, any willingness to compromise. Now, that changed, luckily, since 2013. There was a certain and clearly felt reversal in the negotiation strategy of the Islamic Republic with President Rouhani being in charge. First of all, what changed was that Khamenei clearly for the first time came out not only in favor of having negotiations, but also in favor of being flexible. He called it heroic flexibility. That was something that was very, very dissimilar to the time of Ahmadinejad, where if Khamenei said anything publicly, it was very hard line and do not make any compromises. In 2013, that changed. And it was very clear that Khamenei protected Rouhani inside the system from any really harsh, open, direct criticism by hardliners if he was willing to make any compromises, which gave Rouhani far more leverage than Ahmadinejad might have had if he wanted to have some compromises, which led then first to the interim agreement at the end of 2013, then extension in 2014, and then the joint comprehensive plan of action on the 14th of July 2015. Sorry for the quick ride, but I thought a little bit of a historical background might actually be okay, just to make clear that this is not something that developed in the last 10 or even 20 years. This is an issue that has been dealt with for quite a long time. So what happened in the negotiations in the last 2 years? First, clearly, Rouhani came with a completely new approach to the negotiations. He was willing to make compromises on the Iran side, and that gave and on the P5+1 side. Once Ahmadinejad has left, it was easier to come to a yes. This guy, Ahmadinejad, with his rhetoric about the Holocaust, with his rhetoric about Israel, with his extremely unbending behavior, with 2009 and the Green Movement events, it was really clearly, and this is, I'm sorry to say, also a role in these complex negotiations, it's clearly difficult to come to yes with a character that difficult and that adversary. For example, Iran had previously, before Rouhani, defined a few red lines. There is no reduction in the Iranian enrichment capacity in an end status. There should be no abandoning of Iraq. There should be no abandoning of Fordow as an enrichment plant. And there should be no special treatment of Iran outside the non-proliferation treaty and the additional protocol, which basically asked the P5+1 to accept the status as it is in Iran and simply remove all the sanctions without any additional controls, without any additional restrictions, which clearly even in the hardliners in Iran understood that this is not a goal, the way that an agreement could possibly be reached. That was Ahmadinejad's package of red line. However, with Rouhani, compromises were possible with Iran on each and every one of these points. And therefore, the P5 plus 1 had to recognize this and also compromise on its position, i.e., if you don't, if you might recall, under the presidency of Bush, zero enrichment, zero nuclear technology was a declared openly and several times declared aim of the American administration, meaning at the end of the negotiations, there should be no installations of any kind inside Iran as far as enrichment or conversion is concerned, only one reactor, Bushehr, nothing else, which was, of course, also not exactly the most ideal negotiating position. So that one changed on the P5 plus one side, that there was a recognition that there is a civilian nuclear program in Iran, and the NPT actually gives each signatory, including Iran, the right to use nuclear technology peacefully. So you cannot just arbitrarily define that this only means nuclear energy generating reactors and absolutely nothing else. So you need to come to some kind of an agreement where both sides feel comfortable, the Iranians, that they have a civilian technology, which for them, of course, is also a sign of being a developed economy and a scientific developed society, but also there are sufficient controls and inspections in place that any deviation would be quickly discovered. So what does the agreement actually say? So let me start with the strategic points and then go a bit more into the details. First of all, what is the agreement, what it's not? The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is a staged agreement installing controls and restrictions on Iran's nuclear program for about a decade in exchange for sanctions relief. It is not a revamping of the U.S. or EU relationship with Iran. It does not address issues of terrorism, human rights, and therefore consequently does not remove sanctions on these issues. However, at the same time, in the area of nuclear non-proliferation, the agreement is of strategic importance. And why? Because the NPT, as I said, gives the right to each signatory to have to use in a civilian, non-military way nuclear technology in exchange for each signatory of the party, apart from the five exceptions, foregoing the possibility to have nuclear weapons. The problem with the NPT was that, technologically speaking, the same civilian nuclear technology is absolutely indispensable if you want to have a nuclear weapons program. So the installations look exactly the same, the technology is exactly the same, and in the treaty, no definition is made where civilian ends and military starts. Now, with this rather complicated, I admit, but with this detailed description in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, for the first time in nuclear non-proliferation, you have something like a definition of what a civilian nuclear program could look like and were potentially the limits of a civilian use lie. This agreement can therefore then potentially be used if other states want to go down and with domestic enrichment capability or heavy water reactors to say, okay, before we discuss anything above that, you need to make a good cause why you need more centrifuges than that, why you need more heavy water reactors than that. So it gives a first definition of that, which will be very helpful down the line. So this is something that goes beyond Iran or the current issue, but is of strategic importance for the future. The second importance is, of course, in the area of sanctions architecture. This is clearly one of the cases where sanctions really led to recognition of Iran in this case that compromise is necessary. So the first step that what sanctions should be achieving, economic pressure on a party leading to a decision of that particular party to change its behavior and to compromise, did work. However, in order to keep the instrument intact, there needs to always be also a second step. That means if a compromise is reached, sanctions need to be relieved. If sanctioned parties have the impression that sanctions will be maintained in their current form, whatever the compromise they are willing to make, then they will lose their impact, because the sanctions on Iran were only that effective as they were. They only worked in the way they did because the international community actively supported the sanctions implementation on a global level. That's what integrated economy is hit at the hardest. If a global sanctions regime is implemented by all stakeholders in a very diligent fashion, And as you can see, Cyrus inside Iran, it really did make an economic difference, but because oil played along. Now, in order to keep that, you need to make sure that if a compromise is reached where all of the negotiators feel comfortable with, and this is the case in this case, then you need to relieve sanctions, otherwise you're destroying the instrument. So there is really no clear alternative to the current situation that I am seeing at the moment. The ongoing discussions about the maintenance of the sanctions regime, I find, to be totally honest, and please understand this in the right context, slightly divorced from reality. This sanctions regime, as it exists today, with this compromise, is no longer maintainable. The rest of the world, except some people in America and some people in Israel, is comfortable with that compromise. The pressure that Iran finds itself under economically is because the rest of the world puts economic pressure on Iran. The U.S. did never put any economic pressure on Iran because they had no business with Iran in the first place. It was the Europeans, it was the Russians, the Chinese, it was Asian customers, it was Japan. They put the economic pressure on Iran. The economic sanctions that the U.S. had put in place since 2006 really made no difference to Iran, apart from the fact that they were implemented extraterritorially. That means the U.S. treated every company outside the U.S., if they had any kind of exposure in the U.S. in office and U.S. employee, like it was a U.S. company, which is very questionable as far as international law is concerned, but no one raised that question in a serious way because everyone understood that this is necessary to come to compromise. With the signing of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and the United Nations Security Council sanctions, that is no longer acceptable for the rest of the world. So, and if you look, and I get to this in the sanctions relief, inside the agreement, there is no sanctions relief from the U.S. side in the agreement, at least not in a meaningful way for U.S. companies. And still, this is a good agreement because what Iran will get back is the sanctions relief from the others who implemented it. So what does the agreement do? It's in phases. Just to explain the different terminology that you will find in the agreement, which is of significance if you look about investing or doing business in Iran. At the moment, currently speaking, nothing has changed. Every single sanction that was in place before the agreement is still in place and will remain in place until about spring, summer next year. The adoption day is still ahead of us. It's in about middle, end of November. It will require that the U.S. Congress has finished its review. It is 90 days after the signature of the agreement. Then, between adoption day and the next important step, Iran will implement two in the agreement, which means the reduction of centrifuges, the reductions of enriched uranium stockpile, the redesign of Fordo as a research plant, and a redesign of the Iraq heavy water reactor, plus a very enhanced inspection regime with the IAEA, with a permanent presence of the IAEA in Iran, plus a remote monitoring mechanisms via cameras and sensors in all its nuclear installations, plus the nuclear mine, the uranium mines in the country. So a complete and utter penetration of the IAEA on a permanent 24-hour, 7-days-a-week basis of the entire program. Only once that is finished, implementation day comes. Implementation day means the IAEA will certify to the United Nations Security Council that all of these very difficult technical changes have been made in Iran. Then on that day, the Europeans will relieve their sanctions and the U.S. will relieve some of their sanctions. The next really important stage is then transition day, which is 8 years from adoption day, i.e. November this year plus 8 years. This is where the United Nations Security Council sanctions, which will be maintained until that time, will terminate. And all the restrictions on the ballistic missile program, which are related to the nuclear dossier from the European side, will be relieved. And then finally, in 10 years from adoption day, so November this year plus 10 years, there is the remaining sanctions on the European side that are related to the nuclear dossier plus the weapons are relieved. And the U.S. will try to get legislative sanctions relief. What does what is the trade-off in this phased agreement? So Iran, as I said, has agreed to restrict its nuclear program for at least a decade. Enrichment, heavy water, Fordo, all of these elements have very clearly defined and very clearly measurable restrictions on them. So a specific number of centrifuges of a specific type, P1, for a long time, for the 10 years. A specific amount of stockpile defined by the kilo for 10 years. A specific outline of Fordo, a specific redesign of Arak that is pretty much irreversible unless you want to tear down the reactor. So all of these restrictions are in place for a decade. Plus, you got this enhanced IAEA inspection regime should Iran in any way deviate from these commitments. So it is a very, very, very strong on controls and restrictions. So what's the road ahead? I think the first and most important aspect of the private for the private sector is the sanctions relief question. So let me focus on that for a moment. When are sanctions relieved? I'll be told you on implementation day. So about next spring, next summer. So you see a lot of movement, and I read an article that Eni might have signed an agreement. If Eni has any yesterday, if Eni has any lawyers, they just broken the sanctions and they're in for quite a tough ride from the Europeans as well as the Americans. Sanctions relief will start on implementation day. Not a day earlier, but also not a day later. But implementation day is where the things change. At the moment, you have the possibility that things change. But if there, and I get to this in a minute, if there are any delays, then implementation day might also be at the end of next year. So legally speaking, anything you do that has of any that would violate the sanctions before the agreement will violate the sanctions until implementation day as well, and you do face potential legal consequences if you move. So there is, however, on implementation day, an uneven sanctions relief. On that day, the situation will reverse, sanctions-wise, to about the status of 2006, not the status of 1979 or the 1990s. So the Europeans will, on implementation day, remove, and there are some quite significant sanctions, all the sanctions that were put in place against the financial sector since 2006, against oil and gas, against automotive, against airplanes. So it will simply disappear. One council resolution and all the sanctions will be relieved, including the SWIFT suspension, which means on the day after implementation day, you can transfer money again. And SWIFT is already in discussion with the Iranian financial institutions on how to do that technically, so that once implementation comes, they really simply only have to flip a switch. On the American side, all that is going to happen is that the administration will cease to implement. So not relief, because that is legislated by Congress, but cease to implement the extraterritorial functions of its sanctions, i.e. the idea that any company that has any exposure in the U.S. will be treated like a U.S. company will disappear. For U.S. companies, only one tiny aspect will be changing. You now have the ability to apply for a license with OFAC. Not that you can go directly and work with Iran, but you can apply for a license with OFAC that wasn't in that way there before. So it will, to be totally honest, quite disadvantage the U.S. companies until the end of the agreement, when then the U.S. administration, or in that case, a very future U.S. administration, that is two presidential cycles away, will try to get legislative sanctions relief from Congress. Only then is the possibility that significantly, strategically, the sanctions architecture is going to change for American company. Therefore, if the train leaves in the direction of Iran, I'm afraid the U.S. companies will be quite at a disadvantage. But there are also aspects which might complicate or delay the current agreement. Number one, I mentioned the redesign of Arak. If you look through the agreement, you can actually see, I think it's Annex 4, a very nice technical table on how the Arak reactor should look like. It talks about the dimensions of the heavy water basin. It talks about the reactor core. If anyone wanted to have a lesson on how to convert heavy water to light water reactor, that technical table is definitely worth several PhDs. It's extremely well done. It's extremely smart. However, no one has ever rebuilt a heavy water reactor to a light water reactor in that fashion. So while technically it should work easily, no one knows. No one knows how long that's going to take. The Russian Federation has agreed to help Iran with the redesigning and the rebuilding of the reactor, but it could be delayed. And in difference to Fordo, that is supposed to be converted into a research facility, Iran for Fordo only has to submit a plan to reach implementation date. With Iraq, with Arak, the heavy water reactor, they actually have to make physical the physical redesign of the reactor core. So this could delay it. Then, of course, and that is a very covered aspect in the agreement, until the 15th of December this year, that means in about 4 months, the IAEA and Iran have to submit their final report on the possible military dimensions. If you remember in 2011, the IAEA published an annex to one of its reports on Iran, outlining information that the IAEA had not yet completely confirmed about what I said at the very beginning. These disjunct aspects inside the regime were, in the past, someone clearly toyed with the idea of weaponization. Now, this possible military dimensions aspect has been discussed since that time between the IAEA and Iran. There are a few very concrete things that the IAEA would like to do. They would like to get access to Parchin at one point, and they would like to interview a few scientists. And so far, Iran has been very shy in getting access. Now, my assumption is that Iran will be more flexible on this point, but I'm just pointing out it took 4 years and they haven't finished. So I'm not so sure whether they're going to be able to finish until December, but this is one of the necessary steps to get then eventually to implementation day, which could also then delay implementation day. One problem, of course, and just that's just for your background, the allegations are based into documents that were given in confidence to the IAEA by a few member states, but they were not releasable to Iran. So Iran is confronted with questions whose background the country doesn't know. So they are asked, what is this scientist doing, but they don't know what the exact allegations against the scientist is. So that makes it quite difficult. And as long as the IAEA, and I haven't heard anything differently, is not allowed to release the documents to Iran, so Iran can actually understand what the exact allegation is, it's going to be difficult to give an answer. So that might delay it. And then lastly, once all of this works, and you might have heard something about the Joint Commission, which is basically a decision-making mechanism during the implementation of the agreement, which means and disputes are going to be resolved by that Joint Commission. That Joint Commission has a dedicated procurement channel. The idea is during the agreement, during the 10 years, Iran can legally buy nuclear material and nuclear technology on the international market, but only via a procurement channel, i.e. a central node where all orders go in, get checked, make sure that this is not usable for a military installation, and then cleared, and only then Iran is able to purchase. Now, in theory, that works very well. The practice of my colleagues here looking at the Iran sanctions implementation, when they had a dual-use question to any member state, was that the answer took between 3 months to a year for getting a real confirmed answer, yes, this is civilian, or no, this is too much dual-use. Now, the procurement channel in the Joint Plan of Comprehensive Action assumes a reaction within 2 weeks. So, doable, it's just going to mean that all members of the Joint Commission, i.e. P5 plus 1, will have to build up a lot of personnel capacity in their non-proliferation departments in order to give that answer very quickly, because obviously Iran intends to buy a lot of material and technology in the international market now that it actually can. So that might actually make the implementation tricky, and it might not work as smoothly as it is defined in the agreement. So in conclusion, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is strategically important, A, for nuclear proliferation, and B, for a general sanctions. architecture and in the current situation, looking at the Iran situation between Iran and all of the P5+1, it really is, there is no clear alternative. It implements a decades of restrictions with enhanced monitoring mechanisms from the IEA, and it does not remove any option from the table. So even in decade, Iran would then deviate from the agreement. The agreement doesn't say anything about what happens after the agreement. So if Iran violates the agreement and weaponizes, and any future party feels that this should be answered by a war, or this should be answered by a new sanctions regime, it can. The agreement only says what happens during the decade, not what happens afterwards. It's not a free-for-all, forever card. And sanctions relief, and this is important, will come, but it's mostly focused on European and non-US players. They are going to reap the real economic benefits, and on the flip side, the economic benefits need to be there clearly for Rouhani and Iran as well. If we cannot prove to the government and to the regime in Iran that it was actually worth going through a decade of very intrusive inspections and restrictions on one of the chief national programs, then the Rouhani government will quickly be without political influence, and then we might have to deal with much, much harsher players inside Iran. So for them, it need also be economic beneficial. That's all I wanted to say as my first short presentation, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Schindler, for your insightful comments and wonderful analysis. At this point, we will open the call to questions. I'd like to ask the operator to give instructions on the QA part, and please do keep your questions short, clear, and right to the point.
At this time, to ask a question over the phone, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that's star 1 to ask a question over the phone. And to ask a question over the web, please click the Ask a Question button on your screen to submit a question. We'll pause for just a moment to assemble the queue.
Okay, while we're waiting for the queue to be prepared, let me start with my question, Hans. I mean, optimists like myself, being here in Tehran, believe that this deal would not only improve the lives of Iranians, ordinary Iranians, and the conditions of the business community, which in turn can provide further incentives to the Iranian side to stick to the deal, but it also provides a bigger mandate for the current administration of Rouhani, as you mentioned, to push for reforms and perhaps even take the way towards real democracy in Iran. Is that wishful thinking, Hans? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you that this is an optimistic view of these things. Obviously, with the economic benefits coming from sanctions relief, there is an incentive of the regime as a whole, not just of the Rouhani government, to comply with the agreement. However, as you know, in life, the good or the bad situations are quicker forgotten than the good situations. So the amount of economic pressure the country is under now might not be quite as visible to the regime in 3-4 years from now than it is right now, where obviously economic benefits will quickly create an incentive. However, I do believe also that greater economic engagement will drive the development of the society inside Iran and maybe also some political changes forward quicker than economic isolation. I never thought into that isolation would somehow drive democracy in Iran. I think it's the exact opposite. More engagement will drive democracy. The second part of your question was that paving... for push for reforms. The reforms. What I have seen, and I thought this was actually a very smart way to do. Rouhani was very interestingly using the economic pressure and the economic necessities to rebuild the economic structure, but also the tax structure, the investment structure in Iran, and simply to compensate partially for the falling off of the income from oil and gas, because they had great problems selling that internationally, as everyone knows.
However, the side effect, or maybe also the main intention of that, is that the investment environment in Iran is now much more organized, much better, much more conductive to foreign investment than it used to be even in my time in 2005 before the sanctions came. There was a reform of the tax system. There was a form of the Foreign Investment Protection and Promotion Act, which allowed up to 100% ownership in some sectors of foreign investors of Iranian business ventures. There was a restructuring of the taxation of the religious foundations and the IRGC. So it is a much better, much, much more organized system than it used to be right now. So obviously he used the economic pressure to do that, which will hopefully now help the Iranian economy to get quicker and better investment than it would have been without that. My worry is that it was because of the economic pressure on Iran that these reforms of the taxation and the investment system were possible. And without the economic pressure, partial interest will, as in any other society, will take over again. So while politically I agree with you, economically I'm not so sure if the relief of the pressure will be a reform driving factor, or if it might actually slow down the reform.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Schindler. Operator, I think we have at least four phone calls in the queue, so can you kindly introduce the callers?
Yes, we'll go first to Larry Gross with WPO Angelino.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for the very informative call. Here in the U.S., there's been a lot of talk about this 24-day period for non-declared sites, and I was wondering, clearly radioactive material has a long half-life, but during that 24-day period, could there be non-nuclear material such as testing equipment and triggering mechanisms and laptops and modeling and all kinds of other things that could be moved around in that period, and is that a problem? And also, the agreement between the IAEA and Iran, which apparently is some kind of secret agreement regarding Parchin, which we've heard rumors that maybe the Iranians would be the ones providing the soil samples from Parchin. Is that true, or how is that going to be handled?
Good. Am I already able to answer, or am I still mute?
Yes, go ahead, Hans, please.
Ah, okay, good. The 24 period, what is not really discussed here in the U.S. is the actual capabilities of the IAEA. The 24 period are a red herring of gigantic proportions. The IAEA needs one molecule, one. Removing soil samples, the Syrian tried that. The Syrian removed soil for their suspected site 5 meters and put a 2 meters concrete slab on that. And still the IAEA found the one molecule that they need. The good thing about the weaponization work, about enrichment material, about explosive testings, about testings with lead balls instead of fissile material, this is a way to test an implosion device without actually setting off a nuclear chain reaction. All of this leaves unmistakable changes that can only change over the period of 15 years. So if you do not go and get a soil sample for 15 years, then you're in trouble. Anything beyond that, there is the natural ground radiation will be changed through that experiment. And that change can only occur with this experiment. So the 24 days is, roughly speaking, for 14 years, 340 days earlier than you need it, actually, right? So you can always prove it. So the 24 period is simply something that the IAEA had established as a standard. It depends on how quickly they, on average, are able to get visas, get the inspectors together. You know, this is not something where you can call your secretary from the IAEA to do. You need actual specialists who are always traveling through the world doing this for the IAEA. So that's why it's 24 days, not because 25 days would be already undetectable. So yes, they can remove all the technology, but what they've done there, if it's weapons related, will leave traces in nature that is extremely hard to find. And as I said, the Syrians made great efforts to actually hide their tracks and prove to the rest of the world that you don't waste your time. On Parchin. Parchin was inspected already several times beforehand. What was not done was the inspections of that particular site where allegedly the experiments happened. Now, again, the soil sample from that site and the action of the Iranians from that site really won't make any difference. So if the IAEA gets access to Parchin, to that particular point inside Parchin, which, by the way, is a vast military installation, then we are absolutely without trouble. I don't think that the Iranians are going to supply the soil sample because the IAEA will not touch soil samples that are provided by anyone but the IAEA. So even if the U.S. would provide the soil sample, it cannot be used because there might be some contamination. It's basically simply a scientific process. You need to know exactly know how the soil sample was gathered in order to make a clear analysis. So the access to that one is a long time discussion between Iran and the IAEA for one particular point. Parchin is mainly a military site. Now, if there would be any way that that Iran would feel very comfortable that, yes, you get access to this site, but that doesn't mean that the IAEA will get access to all military sites in Iran, nuclear-related or not, then this would not have been come up. However, the discussion here in America to use the IAEA for targeting purposes for a potential war 10 years down the line is, A, damaging the IAEA very badly, because that's not what the IAEA is supposed to be about, and, B, of course, increases again the suspicions of the Iranian side and the hardliners in the Iranian regime that the access to Parchin is not so much about that particular site. It's about breaking the precedent that you would get access to a purely military site. So it is a tricky issue, but I don't think it's an unresolvable issue. For sure, the 24 days, that's simply not understanding what the IAEA can do, and I'm assuming that I'm not the only one who understands what the IAEA can do, so it's pretty much a political discussion, not a technical one. I hope that answered the question.
And we'll go to our next question from Peter Jepp from the San Diego chapter.
Yes, thank you very much, Hans, for a very interesting presentation. My question is about the confidential agreements and the necessity for them and the range of them, if you can speak to that.
Yeah. You mean the agreements IAEA and each individual member state?
No, the UN and in Iran on confidential agreements that are not made public.
There is no UN-Iran confidential agreement that is not made public. That's just simply wrong, right? I mean, A, the UN never makes confidential agreements. That's simply not how they act. The P5 plus one also don't have a confidential agreement. What happens is that some of the technical aspects of IAEA agreements with member states remain confidential because it relates to specific technology that the member state uses. By the way, also the specific agreement between Germany and the IAEA is not public. It's about configurations of reactors. It's about nuclear safety. You really don't want to, you know, show your computer systems downloadable from the web that the IAEA is going to inspect in your reactors as far as nuclear safety is concerned, so that you demonstrate to the world how to penetrate those systems. So that's the only confidential agreements that I'm aware of. What the IAEA is at the moment discussing and will only make public once it's reached a conclusion is the possible military dimensions issue. That involves access to certain sites, and that involves access to certain scientists whose complete interviews won't be public. But there is no agreement behind the agreement, if that's what you're alluding to. This is it. I mean, we have the Security Council resolution, we have the agreement endorsing that the Security Council resolution endorsed, but from the UN side, that's it. That's it. So the P5 plus one are not a UN mechanism, if you may have thought of that in that way. The P5 plus one are an outside negotiating mechanism. And the Joint Commission and the Procurement Channel, therefore, are not going to be located in New York. They're going to be located in Vienna at the IAEA site. So it's something that goes parallel to the UN. However, the UN process started because the IAEA rules say that if an issue cannot be resolved by the highest decision-making mechanism in the IAEA, the Board of Governors, then the Board of Governors will transfer it to the United Nations Security Council for decision-making. That's how the UN process started. But once it's there, UN processes always have to be transparent. Even reports to the Security Council are getting published.
Thank you.
I'll take our next question from Richard Simon with the WPO President's Action Now Chamber.
Chapter. Great. Thank you very, very much. Dr. Schindler, it's been fascinating. Cyrus, thank you so much for putting the call together. I've had the opportunity, working with Cyrus, to organize three different experiences or trips to Iran for YPO and WPOers. And we actually have another one coming up this October that maybe Cyrus will mention later on, and I'd encourage people to go. My question is, you know, there's no certainty at this point that the U.S. Congress will approve, and the U.S. Congress may end up stopping U.S. involvement in the agreement. I mean, the mechanics, it would be that they disapprove it, the president vetoes the disapproval, but there is possibility of then there being enough votes to overturn the veto, at which point the United States can't be a participant. My question is, and those advocating that believe that then there might be a better deal worked out, my question for you is, what does it really look like, and what options would be there post the United States essentially blowing up the deal or refusing to approve the deal? Or what does that landscape then look like? Thank you very much.
There's no consequences whatsoever. It's over. That's something that the U.S. Congress doesn't understand. The only commitment of the United States in the agreement is to remove the extraterritorial force of its sanctions, which is unmaintainable as soon as foreign government brings an international court case against the United States on the illegality of imposing extraterritorial sanctions. If Congress disapproves and the president vetoes, they take themselves out of the game. The rest of the world is not going to really care about that. There is not going to be a better deal after this. This is it. It only worked because everyone cooperated. No one will cooperate if the U.S. Congress, for no rational reason whatsoever, was simply on the theoretical possibility that there might be a better deal after down the road, will blow up that deal. It will cost the U.S. the rest of the credibility, and it's not going to happen. Everyone is going to go ahead with the deal as planned. It's Security Council endorsed. The Security Council, and I'm working for it, has the really nice thing that it's non-optional. It doesn't matter what the U.S. Congress decides. It's now been endorsed by the highest decision-making council in the world. So if the U.S. decides not to participate, fine, but the deal will still go ahead. It doesn't depend on the U.S. to go ahead. That's something that is completely misunderstood. This is a P5 plus one deal. One of the P5 plus one is the U.S. The rest is not the U.S. So all of these theoretical games that maybe we can maintain the sanctions regime, there's a better deal. No, it's over. Game over, done, you know? And that's something that the U.S. perspective doesn't take into consideration. No one except the Republicans in the Congress and the Israeli government, not even inside Israel, everyone. The Israeli government and the Republicans in this Congress thinks that this is not a good deal and there would be a better deal. If that's the case, and I haven't heard anything else, it really doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Game over. This is the compromise. Learn to live with it. I'm sorry to be so harsh, but, you know, this is not a U.S. agreement with Iran. This is a agreement that six states signed, one of which is the U.S. So there is really no legal consequences to the U.S. Congress opting out. The only commitment is the abandoning of the extraterritorial sanctions, which is page 71, footnote 6. But that's basically saying the U.S. administration will now again adhere to international law, which forbids states to use extraterritorial sanctions. Just as a mind game, how would the U.S. react if Russia would sanction anyone who has an office in Russia, as if there would be Russian companies, if they do business deals with U.S.? That would clearly bring about a reaction that the U.S. is saying this is illegal. This is what happened on Iran on a political understanding that it's necessary. That understanding that it's necessary ended on the 14th of July. So, sorry to be very clear, but yes, this is a nice little Washington problem. The rest of the world, sorry, you know, is not going to change because of that.
So, no apology necessary. Gratitude for explaining it clearly. Any sense as to why that very, very clear explanation isn't more broadly out there? There are massive battles and probably.
I know, because it's presidential.
Right now.
It's a presidential campaign using this issue, right? And it's the Republican side. And I'm sorry, I'm not a member of the Republican or Democratic Party. I am, you know, I live in the U.S., but only because I work for the U.S. Congress. I've been working for the German government under both Republican and Democratic administration, so for me it really doesn't matter, but it is an internal power struggle where one side sees an opening to attack an administration managed by a party from the opposing side and without any real economic consequences. This was always the problem of the Iran discussion here in the U.S. Any congressman, any senator has no political consequences except positive ones if he takes the ultra-hard line on Iran. There is no jobs being lost. There is no lobby group that calls him up and gets on his nerves or organizes against him. It's only positive. You can show yourself tough. You can show yourself tougher in difference to the U.S. administration. You will get some lobby groups instantly supporting you if you do that. What's not to like to be tough on Iran? It doesn't matter why. The tough on Iran bit is absolutely advantageous for you from a political perspective. If I would be a U.S. congressman, I would be tough on Iran. This is a tick in the box that doesn't cost me anything. Jesus, I have a lot of other problems to worry about, healthcare, etc. So that's the problem with the issue, but it completely skewers the view of what is actually going on in this particular area on international politics. And it is a great disrespect of the Republican Party towards the international relations and allies of the United States. I mean, this is also France, Germany, and Britain who signed the agreement, right? So to say that we got to torpedo this by our parliament just for the hell of it, right, it's just basically saying to all of the three allies, you are clowns, and you're just there to make the last page of the agreement look fuller, because if we just had an Iranian signature, that would be too little, right? So it's not strategically in the interest of the United States what happens right now. And unfortunately, because this is such a prominent issue, people are looking very closely from the allies and from more complicated partners like Russia and China. That discussion is looked at very, 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 very in detail. And it doesn't look pretty for the United States. But legally speaking, I'm sorry, this is the way it is, but I understand the tactics of it. But sometimes tactics and international politics don't mesh very well.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Operator, maybe one last quick question. One last quick question. We have 2 minutes.
Okay, we'll take our last question from Bruce Lane with the WPO U.S. Capitol Chapter.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your explanation of the deal. It's been very useful. I have a few concerns I wanted to ask you about. One is, why are we giving Iran the right to enrich uranium when many countries around the world that have nuclear power do not enrich uranium on their soil, including Canada, Mexico, Sweden, Switzerland, Belgium, Argentina, and others? Second, I'm concerned about giving Iran somewhere between $56 billion and $150 billion of money up front, much of which they most likely use to support nefarious activities, against U.S. interests, whether it's in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, elsewhere. We also know that they are doing a lot of things in South America and elsewhere that might be against U.S. interests. Thirdly, why are we allowing Iran to develop ballistic missiles in 8 years? And we know that ballistic missiles are used simply to deliver weapons, which would be used, let's say, to attack Europe or the U.S. So, why do they need ballistic missiles? And lastly, I'm concerned about giving so much faith to the IAEA, which includes no American inspectors. I understand that if the inspectors request access to a site to inspect, if Iran denies that access, then the IAEA inspectors have to decide, well, do they want to ratchet this up and cause a possible breakdown of the deal? Because, you know, if they're denied access, if Iran denies access, and IAEA pushes it further, it could lead to a snapback of these sanctions, which could then unravel the whole deal. So why give so much faith in this whole inspection regime to the IAEA, which also, you know, it could be politicized. They could decide that they don't want to push things and then unravel the deal. I remember when Mohammed al-Baradei ran the organization, he suppressed some of the findings of inspectors because he didn't want to, for whatever reason, he just didn't want to, put out reports saying that Iran was actually, pursuing nuclear weapons technology, et cetera. Those are just some of my concerns, if you could address those.
Okay. You have to have me along. I try to make as much fun as possible. I'm going to go through this if I forget any aspect, just remind me at the end. So the right to enrich, I'm going to say that neither the U.S. nor the T5+1 nor the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action gives Iran the right to enrich. The NPT does. That's the whole point of the NPT. That is a long contention whether Iran has revoked its right to enrich by acting the way it did a few years back, but the right to enrich, the use of the civilian nuclear technology, is deep in the NPT. That's the trade-off for foregoing weapons. So what
can you speak a little closer to the microphone?
That the agreement does is define the way Iran can actualize its right to enrich. It doesn't constitute its right to enrich. That's the NPT. Why do we give so much money to Iran? Because sanctions relief must work as sanctions relief. There is no point putting sanctions in place and then waiting until whatever happens, even if a compromise that the rest of the world feels comfortable with is worked out, then we're still going to continue the sanctions. That's not the way this is supposed to work. Sanctions are an instrument, not a policy. The policy was to get to the compromise. The instrument was sanctions. The instrument was economic pressure. If the policy is economic pressure, it's nonsense. Economic pressure for what aim? And of course one can define like certain statuses of what a better agreement would look like. However, no one ever has. They knew this was coming for 2 years, anyone who was critical of that, and they had been asked numerous times of what a better agreement would look like, and they couldn't come up with anything that's except for the fact that there should be no nuclear installations in Iran. It's very nice, and I love to have $1 million in my bank account, but sometimes life needs to be realistic as well as wishful. So the money is because of the sanctions relief. Is there a risk that Iran might use this for nefarious activities? Absolutely. That's why we have all of the other sanctions regimes who can be extended, harshened up on terrorism, on human rights, on the weapons in place for 10 years. So that's, at minimum, we have all of that. And then after the 10 years, you still have the terrorism and human rights sanctions measures that you can increase again. And there's still agreement that these aspects of Iranian behavior is not good in the region. So it's not a free card for all of the other stuff. It's simply sanctions relief based on the nuclear dossier, and that will bring money to Iran. That's the whole point. If it doesn't bring money to Iran, well, do sanctions relief. Why would the Iranians compromise if they don't get anything in return? That's the nature of an agreement, not a capitulation document. The inspections, yes. The IAEA, unfortunately, is the only organization that inspects nuclear installations. It takes a lot of money, a lot of expertise, a lot of experience to do this in a good way. There is simply no other mechanism. I know that there are some critical voices towards the IAEA being not harsh enough, and trust me, there is equal amount of people outside the U.S. who think the IAEA is unfair in the other way around. As I said, I already mentioned, making allegations, not providing the background to the allegations or the specific of this is not exactly a soft approach towards the Iranian problem. So, yes, I understand that sometimes under Baradei, the position of the IAEA was not as hard as the Bush administration would have wished.
However, indifference to him and Amano was that he only presented stuff that the IAEA internally was completely sure that was true, and he presented all the documents. The deal was, I present anything to Iran that you allow me to explain to Iran why. That was the hurdle that Baradei put in place. That's the hurdle that Amano took away. So in a way, it's a small difference, right? But you could defend either position on that one. Why the snapback provisions on the inspections? Simply because that is one of the mechanisms to ensure that the IAEA gets access to these sites. So if there's a suspected site and the IAEA doesn't get to an agreement with Iran, and then the Joint Commission doesn't get to an agreement with Iran, the sanctions will snap back. That's the whole point, to ensure that the access is given by Iran eventually. And because they know the systematics, so IAEA, Joint Commission, Security Council, sanctions, the chance that they might get access earlier in that process is greater. So that's why it's in there. Yes, it might unravel the agreement, but that's the whole point of the agreement, that these inspections and these restrictions are there for the 10 years that the agreement runs, and then after the 10 years, you go back to the additional protocol, which, by the way, is having a lot of the elements that are in the agreement also inside, and by the way, the Americans nor the Israelis have ever signed. So it's more than anyone else is prepared to do. Only Germany and a handful of other states who have nuclear programs have signed additional protocols. So it will still be the highest level of controls, globally speaking, that the IAE will have, even after the decade of the even more intrusive inspections. I hope I addressed everything. Did I forget any aspect?
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Schindler. The discussion has been so engaging that we're almost 10 minutes over time. So let me thank you again for taking time to provide the great insight that you have on today's call. Everybody else, thank you so much for connecting to the call. As mentioned, a podcast of the call will be available within 1 hour, and the webcast link will also have a recording. Dick Simon also mentioned that there will be another event in Iran. For those of you interested in seeing Iran visiting and seeing things up close and personal, there will be a chapter event run by the WPO President Action Now chapter. And please visit the Global Diplomacy and Public Policies Network homepage for more information about the network. And if you're not a member, please join. Thank you all. Have a great, great day.
Thank you. Thank you to all, and thanks for all the cool questions. I really enjoyed answering them.
Fantastic, Hans. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Good day, everyone.
And that does conclude today's conference call. We appreciate your participation.